That's to synchronize audio, Z-Pak, okay? Because I have with me today a very special guest, a Stanford professor type. Why? Because I'm in the Bay Area doing shows on the road, and a good friend of mine, Dr. Patrick Ha, who you've seen on this show, and his wife, Julie, introduced me to Dr. Holly Tabor, who is Associate Professor of Medicine at Stanford and Chair of some kind of bio...
Yeah, I'm Associate Director of the Stanford Center for Biomedical Ethics here at Stanford.
What a gunner. Oh my gosh. So bioethics is interesting to me because I don't really understand what you guys do, but we often rely on you in these really difficult times. Like someone comes in with a DNR tattoo on their chest, but you honor it, right?
Right.
Or, you know, there's a conflict in the ICU of a million different kinds. Mm-hmm. And so you sit on the committee here as well.
I do. And actually, I'm about to be the co-chair of the committee too. So, so I do a lot of that work and I help run the ethics consultation service here at the adult hospital. And I'm also on the children's hospital committee.
Wow. Yeah. So you do patients of all ages then?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I focus more of my time on adults, but yes, all ages.
Got it. Mm-hmm. So, and over here, Packard is our children's hospital, and so that's where you see the kids. Well, here's a question. So how did you get into this? Because when I call an ethics consult, again, it's like this black box. Sometimes there's a hospitalist on there.
Yeah.
There's like some weird professorial type. Mm-hmm. There's always like just strange stuff.
Yeah.
How did you become a...
Well, there are two parts of that, I think. What is the ethics committee do and who's on it? And then how did I get into it? I got into it through a very circuitous roundabout way, as I think sometimes some people have interesting stories in medicine and related fields of how they got into doing what they're doing. So I actually started out majoring in history of science in college, and so I was really interested.
That's a thing?
That's a thing. At some places, it's a thing, yeah.
Wow, so like Pasteur, boy.
Yeah, yeah, and a lot of Koch postulates and infectious disease.
You mean the ones that aren't true according to Duesberg, who says
exactly.
HIV doesn't cause AIDS?
So, yeah. I did my undergrad research thesis on diphtheria screening in the 20s. So that was like way back when. So
when you defended your thesis, did you dress as a flapper?
I did not, but that would have been good. I wish I'd done pertussis? I think if I did it now, maybe I would have actually done that.
The coughing flapper. That would have been a legendary PhD defense.
Then my defense would have been viral.
It would have been viral, even in all over YouTube.
Yeah. So I majored in that. I was really interested in the intersections between science and society. I thought I wanted to be an MD. And so a lot of people who do history of science, at least where I was, it's a way to also be pre-med and do something that's not just straight science, straight bio. And so I thought I wanted to be an MD, but I was also really interested in research. So after college, I decided I wanted to do research for a while, and I did epidemiology research actually at UCSF up in San Francisco.
My hood!
Yeah.
So you're all over my place, man.
I know, we had a lot of connections.
You didn't go to Berkeley at any point.
No, I didn't go to Berkeley. Did that and kind of fell in love with epidemiology and decided I actually wanted to do epidemiology research. So came back to Stanford, actually to a building that's like right over there, and started a PhD in epidemiology. So that was like twist one. Then I took a genetics course and got really interested in the emerging field of genetic epidemiology. And so I sort of dove into genetics. And I actually did my dissertation research in a genetics lab here at Stanford, focusing on candidate gene approaches to complex traits, which is like a whole other topic about genetics.
Wow.
But partly because of my interest in the intersections between science and society, I got really interested in ethical issues in genetics. And I did a postdoc that was kind of retraining basic scientists to be ethicists here at the Stanford Center for Biomedical Ethics.
Training basic scientists to be ethicists.
In part, it was a funding through the National Human Genome Research Institute, NIH, and it was really trying to get people who had a really firm understanding of the science to be thinking about ethics and to be thinking about what kinds of research questions we have to ask in ethics around genetics, which is a funding mandate of the National Human Genome Research Institute.
Ah, okay, so they're mandated to do this because, you know, the Nazis did all kinds of genetic stuff,
exactly.
But there was zero ethics.
Yeah, that's part of it, which is also where a lot of our research regulations come from that govern IRBs and informed consent and so forth. But also, when the Human Genome Project was funded initially, there actually was a set-aside, a requirement for a certain proportion of it to be dedicated to ethical, legal, and social implications of genetics research.
Oh, okay.
So to this day, it's actually a congressional mandate for a percentage of the NHGRI budget to be focused on ethics. Ethics research.
Cool. So you kind of filled that space and you were training these scientists to think like less like scientists and also like people who are trying to think ethically and what are the consequences of.
And some of that is philosophical principles of ethics. The thing you were saying, you call an ethics consult in a hospital and you don't know who you're going to get. It is a very multidisciplinary field, and it's been a little amorphous, and there's actually an effort in the field to sort of consolidate. I can talk about that in a second. But so I started this training to focus on ethics issues in genetics. And as part of that, I'm like, oh, I should learn about clinical ethics. I should find out what that's about. I should find out what clinical ethicists do. I should get some training in that so I understand it, because it's such a foundational part of like autonomy and beneficence and non-maleficence and justice, the four classic principles of bioethics. And
so one of the principles of bioethics was a Disney movie starring Angelina Jolie.
Maleficence. Right. Yeah, kind of. Yeah, that's a good point. I should make a slide with that. That's
I'm just saying. I'm always thinking, people.
Yeah. So I really loved clinical ethics, and I actually really enjoyed doing it, and actually complemented the sort of more the less tangible research I was doing. I love my research, but it's a lot less tangible than dealing with the kinds of ethical issues that you see in the hospital and even in the outpatient setting. So I really did a lot of training in clinical ethics and made that a key part of what I do. And so ever since then, what I do is really largely, a large part of my work is focused on clinical ethics. And so we have JCO requires hospitals
to have... Oh, you said the J word. I want to say this. said JCO. She didn't say the Joint Commission. No. She said JCO.
Is that bad?
No, you're with me. Okay. I always get crapped on because people are like, you know, they haven't been called themselves JCO for 15 years. And I'm like, they haven't earned anything but a JCO.
Well, I'm probably going to correct me if I get stuff wrong.
No, you got it right.
So they require some kind of ethics committee for most hospitals, but they don't say what that is. So there's actually kind of a joke that an ethics committee can be like a rabbi, a priest, and a box of donuts. And
that's what it is. That's what it is at the other hospital, community hospital across the bay where I worked. It was like, let's call the ethics committee. It's like, why is the least ethical guy I know chairing the committee?
That's not a good sign.
Yeah, exactly.
So, but I think at most academic medical centers, and certainly places I've worked, there's an effort to make an ethics committee include people who have expertise to be representative of different stakeholders within the institution. So really trying to have people with different disciplines be involved, because I can't even tell you the number of times that nurses, respiratory therapists, other people have a different, social workers have different perspectives on the ethical issues that if you just had physicians in the room, you wouldn't necessarily hear that perspective. And then
that makes perfect sense. Yeah.
And then also there's actually an effort in my field to actually do certification and training for ethics consultants. So in the very near future, there actually will be more of a formal certification process and a sort of test to show that you actually have the basic skills and the competencies, which a test which presumably I and others who do this work will pass, but also a path to help trainees to learn how to do
that. Yeah. Well, so let me ask you a practical question then. So there, all of that is your path to get to this. I'm Charlie Gard's parents, and I'm in London and in the hospital, and I want to do X. I want to take him out to the Vatican. And we call y'all. We call the ethics consult, because the hospitalist is like, the pediatric hospitalist is like, I'm out. It's too much. I don't know what the answer is. How does this process then, how do you start thinking about this? How do you intake the information of the patient?
Well, the Charlie Gard case and what are called sort of futility or medical ineffectiveness cases are kind of their own. They have some unique features to them, especially in certain national and even state contexts. So I could address just that. But I think if someone calls a consult, maybe I can twist the example a little bit to be a consult from the ICU. The patient has an advanced directive that says he would only want this and not that, and the wife says something else, and the son says something else. And the
that
team,
never happens. And the By team, the way, this is totally theoretical. We never see this.
And the team thinks that they really shouldn't do this procedure, you know, and so there's conflict. And there's conflict about values, and there's conflict about effectiveness. There's conflict about professionalism and professional ethics and what providers are obliged and not obliged to do under certain circumstances where we think that things will or won't work. And I think in our institution, and I think in a lot of institutions where there's an active ethics committee and ethics consultants, we come in and we talk to as many of the involved parties as we possibly can. So we talk to the treating team, and that is we try to make that the whole team and as many of the affiliated teams as we can. We talk to the patient if the patient's able to talk to us. We talk to the family members, either the actual surrogate or if sometimes we're deciding who the most appropriate surrogate is, if that's not clear. And we have conversations. We provide feedback about the law, about our policies here at our institution, which are guided by the law. And we help with negotiation, decision-making, conflict mediation, sometimes over several meetings. And we usually make a recommendation. Our recommendations are not binding.
Right. So,
Yeah. So we're not the police. And the goal is not to say, always not to say you shouldn't be doing that. We say we never do that, but we mostly don't do that. And to be collaborative, but also to try to sort of improve communication, improve outcomes. A lot of it ends up being conflict mediation. A lot of it ends up being we have more time to sit and listen and talk with people than a lot of other people do. So sometimes just by our going around talking with everybody or getting everybody in the same room to talk, we can often provide clarity or help everyone get to a place where everyone can say, oh, okay, the problem here is actually X, not Y. Problem here really is the family is really traumatized by worrying about the patient being in pain. And so they're saying all these other things, but that's not actually really what they're worried about. They're worried about pain, you know, or they're worried about time to have this other family member come visit or, you know, so you end up kind of getting at what the real core issue is.
And it often seems to be that that's the case, that the stated problem is actually a veneer over what's really going on. And the primary team may not have time to get at the heart at what's going on. They may not have the capacity or the skill set to get at the heart. So even though we're encouraged to have these great bedside manners and we practice on fake patients and we do all that, most of us are a little bit off in terms of our ability to really draw it out. And some are gifted. Now, I think this can actually be trained into people.
I think so too, although I actually, your TED Talk where you talk about the empathy robot. I think I agree it can be taught. I think some people are better than others. I think some disciplines encourage it and cultivate it more than others.
So
I'm not going to name any disciplines, but some disciplines are better than others.
I will.
you can. And I'll just look around.
Yeah, right.
But I think that the other thing that I have, so I actually have a PhD, not an MD, but I've been working doing this kind of work for a while. And I actually think that, and I have colleagues who also have backgrounds in philosophy and other kinds of disciplines, but who've worked in healthcare enough that they really know a lot of the lingo. They know about what they don't know. They know when to ask questions, but we actually get the privilege of being able to say, I'm sorry, I don't understand that. Why can't you do the X? Or
so you
why
get to
isn't
dig,
why?
Right, right.
And
almost from a patient type
And sometimes we know what the answer is or we guess what the answer is and we're right. But I think even asking that question, there's a way you can ask that by not being an MD that is, I think, sometimes illuminating and also less threatening to physicians.
Yeah.
Because it's like, well, I don't understand. Why?
you know?
And then they're like, well, now that you mention it, I'm not sure why. You know. So you can have different kinds of conversations.
This happens quite a bit. Yeah. And like you said, nurses are a big part of it. Doctors are, and all their perspectives are important to loop in.
Yeah.
And it's a JCO requirement to have an ethics committee.
That's my understanding. We can check that and
feels out. Right to me.
But I think what it is and what it looks like is not specified, or at least it didn't used to be.
But one thing we do know, you can't have open drinks while you're judiciarating. Is that the word, judiciarating, on a case? Because if JCO's involved, they're like, you can ethicalate, but you can't drink Snapple while you do it.
No, or no, there are probably other weird things, like no open-toed shoes while you're...
you know, exactly. Right. Wait a minute now.
Yeah. Okay.
It's the Stanford way.
It's the Stanford way. You're very
Indian dad.
In your natural habitat.
Sir. Yeah, exactly. My Indian dad is constantly saying, why are you wearing your chappals everywhere you go? You know, it's so unprofessional. Everybody else has the nice Rockport. Because Rockport, very fancy.
I love your dad. I've never met your dad, but I feel like I've met him through your videos.
By proxy. Yeah.
But yeah, so I think ethics committees, part of our job is to listen. Part of our job is to provide clarity. And I think the other thing we do that's not in the real time is, hey, we've been seeing a lot of consults happening around X. What's going on there in a systems way? What is going on with our policy there? Is there some reason why that keeps happening? Can we work collaboratively to kind of figure out ways we can mitigate, prevent this stuff from happening?
Bigger picture stuff that you're picking up because you're seeing these consults over time.
Yeah.
And are you always on the committee, or do people rotate in and off?
People rotate in and off. Yeah. I appear to be always on the committee. Yeah. But, I mean, I'm going to be co-chair of the committee, but we do rotate people on. We try to rotate people, not so frequently they don't get to benefit of experience, but we try to have new people come on. We also try to have community members, mm-hmm. because it's pretty important that community members also have a different perspective than hospital employees. So we do that, and we try to often have members of communities that we think issues come up around. And when I was at my previous institution, we intentionally had some people who had disabilities and represented disability communities, because we frequently had consults around that. So that's part of it. I mean, obviously it's hard to have representation that you would want to have from as many communities as possible, but we try to mix it up a lot. And then we have a consult service, so we take turns being on call 24/7, and we get a lot of, we're an active service.
Busy. Yeah, especially at an institution like Stanford, where all kinds of stuff is hitting the fan, tertiary referral center. Let me ask you a favor. I'm going to have you move your phone.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
No, just because it's going to vibrate our audio.
Oh, no.
And then this is what will happen. I'll get these emails.
Yeah.
Did you have move a vibrator phone on the table? Like, what's going on? I'm like, it's called a phone.
Very observant audience.
Ethically. Yeah, they are. They are. They're going to say all kinds of things like, Z-Dog, why is your head shiny? Because I'm bald. Okay. Number next. Speaking of that, now there was a, what was I going to ask you about the ethics of, or ethical questions around, patients or community members who are sort of in an unhealthy way, either attacking or threatening or stalking medical professionals. Do you get involved with that? Because a lot of our audience has, especially our nurses, have suffered a lot of violence, as we see opioid epidemic getting worse, mental health crisis getting worse. Is that a purview of what you guys do at all?
No, that's a really interesting question. I've definitely seen you guys talk about that on your show and the different things that you guys put out. To the degree that everything in the hospital is in our purview, yes, it is. I think I personally haven't had much specific work that I've done on that recently, but I do think we are constantly talking about navigating really high stress situations where patients and family members or surrogates who are in there often push boundaries of behavior that veer into the kind of situation that I think you're talking about.
Right.
And how do we ethically provide care? How do we even legally fill our mandates of what we're required to do under EMTALA in certain situations while still also being a safe workplace, while still maintaining professional integrity and professionalism. And I think it's an ongoing struggle. I know you guys have talked about this, and I don't think anyone has completely clear answers yet. We are not the people anyone calls first or probably second or third either.
Right.
But I think the issues of how we not only set boundaries, but also coach staff to know how best to handle a situation, as it's starting to occur is certainly an institutional issue that we and others are thinking about a lot.
Yeah, because it's like you said, I think we're trying to figure out what are those boundaries? When have those boundaries been crossed? Mm-hmm. When is it unethical to ask a nurse to continue to see an abusive, a verbally abusive, a sexually abusive patient? And I imagine those things, it's interesting. When I was working full-time as a hospitalist at Stanford, we didn't see it that much. It seems to be very rampant in the community.
Really.
And especially in emergency departments, you're seeing very sick. And you mentioned EMTALA too, like what are our obligations, our legal and ethical obligations around EMTALA? By the way, can you help me?
Yeah.
This is something, Z-Pak, that always comes up in my mind. The difference between ethics and morals. Because
the hard questions.
I like the hard questions. I got smart people. I'm going to take advantage of it.
So, and other people will probably answer this question differently and possibly better, but I think morality, so there's morals and there's morality, right? To some degree, morals are sometimes considered to be equivalent with values. And values can sometimes be driven by societal morals and values, by religious or spiritual morals and values, Ten Commandments, the things you shouldn't do. Sometimes they're driven by...
Thou shalt not get just one Little Caesar's pizza.
Exactly.
There must be two.
There are rules.
There are rules. This isn't NOM.
And there are also morals that people and values that people should share and that people disagree on, even in a fairly free and diverse society under ideal circumstances, which you can argue about whether that's where we are right now or not. But I think ethics is sort of a, I think of as a system of thinking about and framing questions and using a variety of tools, including morals, to inform what you think the right thing should do.
Mm-hmm. So they're really more rules, and they're informed by morals. And again, I'm mansplaining this because I'm trying to understand.
No, it's good.
But it's more of a code.
Well, it can be a code, mm-hmm. but it's also a process. It's a framework and a process. Okay. So part of that could be professional societies have ethics guidelines, right? I mean, almost every medical professional society has some form of ethics guidelines that they create for their profession.
Correct.
And there are things that are common across all of those for nurses and social workers and different kinds of physicians and so forth. And then there are things that are different.
You know?
And I think the things that are the same are maybe the most shared values.
Yeah.
And the things that are the same in our professional ethics societies for our professional ethics guidelines in the U.S. may not be the same in other parts of the world, right?
Right.
And they aren't about disclosure, about informed consent, about all sorts of things, about paternalism, all that can vary. So I think of ethics as sort of a system of sort of of processing and explaining and helping people navigate what our professional obligations are and trying, again, to balance benefits and harms and doing good and trying not to do harm. In that context of the broader social context.
Related to that, so it's a requirement, maybe it's an mm-hmm. ethical thing to do informed consent. Mm-hmm. Is our informed consent system as it currently stands broken and useless, or is it perfect?
It's broken.
Yeah.
I don't know that it's useless because I think I was actually in a meeting the other day where people were talking about what's the point in asking people about, this wasn't someone at Stanford, but what's the point of asking people for informed consent about use of their samples when once samples are de-identified, they get broadly shared regardless of what you've said about them, which is a whole other episode mm-hmm. topic. And my response to that was that the process of informed consent, even if it's flawed, is still very important, both to the patient or the research participant and to the provider or the researcher and the institution and to society. This idea that you have to ask permission, I think, is really important. And the idea that you have to have enough information to make an informed choice.
Right.
But the reality is we do it badly.
No one
remembers anything they're told or that they sign. I sign these for myself and for my kids. And so
it's like in Apple's terms and conditions. You're like, accept.
Yeah. Yep. And I think, and then people are like, wait a minute, I didn't realize I was signing.
I have to form a human centipede as part of using my iPhone.
You're going to take what out?
Yeah, exactly. You
know?
What?
I have to stay in this hospital how long? So I think it's a very flawed. I think, again, we have to move more towards a communication model that makes informed consent part of ongoing communication. But I do think that there's some function to a formality. I think we have to innovate the way we do it so that people can consume the information in a way that makes it more meaningful to them. But we're not there yet.
Makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Now, one of the interesting things that you work on as a personal passion and also mm-hmm. a professional passion mm-hmm. is disabilities.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And the ethics around how do we take care of people with disabilities? Mm-hmm. How does that care actually influence the care of so-called well and healthy, normally abled? I don't know what the term is.
Yeah.
By the way, I've been accused occasionally because I'm you got to understand, I'm a conditioned blob of goo that walks around just spewing stuff, especially when we're live. I'll just be like, blah, 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 blah. And I've been accused of saying words and things that are construed as ableist and so I would love to learn more about your work with disabilities and the ethics around that. And why did it start? Like, it's a personal thing.
Yeah, it is. Well, so I actually did some research in early part of grad school on genetics and autism. It wasn't the main part of my
genetics and autism.
Genetics of autism.
But isn't it all just vaccines? Like, well, there's no genetic component.
Yeah, that's a whole other. You've done a couple shows on that. Yeah, anyway, it was interesting. It was back in the day. It was one of, if not the largest family-based studies of autism back in the day. So anyway, I had some exposure to autism through that work, but it was a student. And I was in a lab, and I wasn't really interacting. I was doing lab-based stuff, not actually interacting with patients and families. And in one of those great ironies of life, several years later when I had kids, my oldest son was diagnosed with autism when he was about 3 years old. So I sort of have both then and later some professional connections to thinking about autism in particular, but disabilities. But then I also have the personal experience of being a parent of a child with a disability. And then I have this sort of ethics hat. I talk about wearing multiple hats. I also have this ethics hat where I interact with parents of children and children and adolescents themselves, and increasingly adults with all sorts of disabilities, developmental disabilities, physical disabilities, intellectual disabilities, so all kinds of things. And I think my kind of lenses are different, if that's the right metaphor, for thinking about how disability is perceived by healthcare and how people with disabilities and families with family members with disabilities interact with the healthcare system. And I keep feeling like, you know, what's it called when you're doing the ophthalmological exam and they change the lenses so you can suddenly see more clearly?
I call it this, number one or number two.
Yeah.
Number one.
And then you're like, I don't know which one is better. Yeah. But sometimes you get the change and it's like, oh my God, that's so much clearer. Yeah. I feel like that's what's happening with me in thinking about healthcare and disability and continuing to happen, is something will happen and I see the issues totally differently. So partly because of my personal experience and my professional experience, I've gotten really interested in the ways our healthcare enterprise doesn't meet the needs of people with disabilities.
And this is nuanced. It's not like, do we have a handicap ramp? I'm just going to reframe this here. Come closer, my darling. I know I'm creepy.
No, you're not creepy.
But this is what happens.
I'm just starstruck.
No. You know. It's funny. Every time, guys, every time I do an interview, it starts out, we're in tight and frame. Then I start talking and the guest starts to back up because I am creepy AF.
No, not creepy. We just need like two straws and a drink and then we'd be close enough.
Like a Jimmy Buffett sort of scenario. Exactly.
I will try to stay.
We got our little microphone here. We're a pro operation. I'm on the road, I don't have Tom and Logan to help me. Normally Tom would show up behind us and like just kind of like, hey. So it's not just ramps and wheelchair accessible stuff. You're talking about your experience walking into a crowded waiting room, being forced to wait with a child for whom that much sensory overload, that much stimulation is not necessarily the best fit for how it's set up.
Yeah, and that's partly my personal experience is that, and I've told this story a couple of times, but I even recently took my son to a healthcare visit with a specialist, and everyone in your audience probably will have had this. It's a room that's really crowded, full of kids who don't want to be there, and they're screaming, and there's a TV playing a really loud cartoon, but the cartoon is so loud.
Yeah,
I mean,
right?
It's so loud. No one can hear this cartoon, and it's just like noise. I feel bad for the people who work there. I actually said to the receptionist last time I was there, I was like, how do you manage that? And she's like, oh, I don't even hear it anymore.
So. It's like a Teen Titans is going, the night begins to shine. Believe me, I watch this cartoon because of my kids. So loud cartoons.
Loud cartoons and then weights, because we don't have, all clinical settings like that have weights and indeterminate weights, especially for some specialties. And so recently with my son, we were waiting for an hour and 45 minutes. And
that's nothing.
And it is nothing. But we were told there was some weight, and he's a good self-advocate, and he took one look at this room and was like, yeah, no way, I am not sitting there. And I knew that might happen, so I'd arranged for my husband to take off work. He took him for a walk. I said I'd call them when it was time to come in. So we, because of our knowledge and resources, were able to sort of strategize around that. But most people can't do that. And it's not fair. And what happens is the kid doesn't get into the visit, or they get into the visit and they're already more anxious and escalated. They can't communicate about what's bringing them there. Communication is so important in the assessment and the exam. And again, it's not just for kids. It's for adults too, that adults with disabilities have, particularly intellectual and developmental disabilities, have trouble communicating. And you need them to tell you what hurts, and they need you to tell you why they don't feel good. And if they've already had this very amplifying experience. So the waiting room is just one example. But if I can...
We never think about these things.
Well, it's true, but the thing is, it's true for everyone. So this is the whole sort of universal design idea that if you fix things or you improve things for people with disabilities, you actually improve things for everybody. And Apple's kind of done that with thinking about how some of their technology that helps people with disabilities actually improves their technology for other people. Other tech companies have done that.
But their accessibility tab on there in the settings make things big, Zoom.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I think we can also think in medicine about, how we can use technology, but also how we can train people and give them easy use tools. We're not going to send everybody back to week-long trainings on how to do this. So how can we use what we have, and how can we innovate where we are to address that? Yeah, what do you have there?
So what I have here, and I can't open them because it'll actually start using it for audio.
Yeah.
These are Apple AirPods.
You pull
them out and you stick them in. So what Apple's...
Yeah. Oh, okay, I didn't recognize the case.
Yeah. So what Apple's been doing is they are setting it up so that you can use your iPhone, which I'm recording on right now, with these earpods and use the microphone on the iPhone to amplify. So it's almost like an impromptu hearing aid in crowded situations.
That's,
and and it's directional because the iPhone is designed to pick up the person in front of you. So this is a great example of design within the reach that helps everybody, but particularly people with maybe hearing disabled.
Well, it helps with outcomes. It helps with, you know, traditional healthcare outcomes like morbidity and mortality, but it also, and satisfaction.
Satisfaction, I mean, for sure, you know, which is the only outcome we care about, Press Katie.
Oh, well, I got a survey after that thing. And I was like, okay.
She filled it out.
And I got a call afterwards. So
when you get a call.
Like, here's my number. You
when
can
you
call
get a
me.
Call,
But I mean, I said when I talked to the person, hey, I'm on your side here. Mm-hmm. Like, it's nobody's fault. Nobody's doing this intentionally.
Right.
Nobody's, you know, everybody's doing their best. But how can we think creatively about how we can do better and how can we create opportunities for advocacy or self-advocacy for people, whether it's in pediatrics or in the adult setting. So the other way, if I can tell you about another story, my family and my son have gotten really involved in Special Olympics, and last 2 weeks ago, we were in Seattle for the Special Olympics USA Games 2018, and I'd never been to that or anything like that before, and I have to say the whole thing was an amazing experience, and I'll just give a shout out. Actually, ESPN did a really nice one-hour thing about it. But one of the things they did that's really relevant to this discussion in your audience is they have increasingly in the last couple of years started a healthy athletes program, partly because they recognize that most Special Olympics athletes and most people with disabilities of the kind that are included in Special Olympics have tremendous unmet healthcare needs. Tremendous.
Really? You would think they're in the Special Olympics.
No, and that's exactly right. By being in the Special Olympics, they already are a specialized subset of people with disabilities who've gotten themselves there, who've likely had some sort of physical screening exam to be allowed to participate. So you're right, but still, it's tremendous. And so they do this on the state level, but at the national level, for the first time, they had a whole clinic in the University of Washington opened up a whole floor with all these stations for different kind of healthcare things for all the athletes to go through. And they had it open for the longest they've ever had it open for 6 days of the whole session.
Yeah.
And they saw, I got some data, some preliminary data about it. They saw a total of over 7,000 athletes while they were there and of all ages. And they were looking at a bunch of different areas. They were looking at dental health.
Yeah, which is a big deal because the oral system link and everything. Yeah,
vision, hearing, general health promotion, BMI, that kind of thing, and healthy eating and habits. And then podiatry, feet. And one of the incentives to get people to do this was they partnered with Brooks, and they actually were giving free Brooks shoes of the correct size to anyone who went through at least a certain number of stations at this screening.
Wow.
And so they were these awesome shoes. I bought some. They were awesome. So it was a great, you know, who doesn't want that? That's awesome.
Did they have closed toes? Because I'm telling
you. Yes, they did have closed toes.
Chappers don't even have toes.
Your father would be.
He would be happy with
that. Slightly less than the Rockports, but still pretty good. So so the interesting thing I want to share about that, and they were also giving out free glasses on the spot with the correct prescription.
Wow.
And the director of it was telling me that at another healthy athletes event she was at, she met a kid who was getting glasses and apparently had previously had glasses. And she said, well, what happened to your glasses? And he said, oh, well, I have these bullies at school and they broke my glasses and my mom can't afford glasses. Aww. So we had to wait till the next Special Olympics event for me to get glasses. So anyway, just to some summary of the data, and Dave Lennox, who's head of Washington Special Olympics, helped me out with this. Over 50% of them had the wrong shoe size, And 8 of them had sort of urgent referrals as a result of that from feet injuries from having the wrong shoe size. Wow. So this is basic. Like they can't even have trouble connecting with the right people to explain that their feet hurt because they have the wrong shoes. The other interesting things were 23% didn't pass the hearing exam. Over 46% got glasses and had the wrong, needed a new prescription. And then this was the one that really got me, the number of dental issues. There were 64, or about 5% of them, who had urgent referrals for dental problems.
Wow.
So they're healthy enough to get to the games. They're healthy enough to get the health screening. They come and they have these urgent
dental
problems.
They need a root canal.
I mean, yeah, they're in pain. They're in pain and potential health consequences from having dental problems, a broader health, right? And so it was shocking. I mean, and many more of them had, I think, 17% or about had untreated tooth decay. So really serious health problems. And they're waiting. They had a dental van where they were doing procedures. Mm-hmm. And there was a wait. And people were waiting there for hours to get these free assessments.
So how on earth is this population... It's almost like an impoverished homeless population in terms of the access, mm-hmm. the dental issues, yep. the shoe issues,
yep.
the hearing and vision issues. Mm-hmm. It's like we're dealing with homeless clinic at San Francisco UCSF.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know those numbers, but it does seem to me like it. And these are people who probably have a doctor. And yeah. so why is it? And I was actually asking some of my colleagues there, well, why is that? And I think it's a couple of things. Some of it is access. Mm. Like sometimes it's just literally hard to get an appointment if you have kinds of disabilities where you have to navigate the healthcare system. Right. So I think that's part of it. I think a lot of it, which I think is one of the key areas to target, and my colleague Dave Lennox was saying this too, is providers opening their minds to thinking about how the encounter goes and thinking about how they communicate with people with disabilities. Huh. I think especially with intellectual and developmental disabilities, providers, especially in pediatrics, but even in adult care, frequently talk to the family member, the person's
right,
there.
Right, right, and now, they're sitting right
I got
there.
5 minutes, what's going on? Yeah. Tell me what's going on, I'm gonna talk to
How's
you,
Tommy? Yeah.
dad, you, brother, not to the patient. And there are reasons for that, but that misses an opportunity to engage the patient in a way the patient can engage back with you. And it's also based on, you were talking about ableism, I think we all, I mean, this is implicit bias in the data, implicit yeah. bias. We're all ableist,
yeah.
right? And just saying we don't want to be isn't enough.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So how do we create systems so we don't have to think about whether we're being ableist?
I want to commend you for saying that.
Yeah.
That to me is a crucial thing. Don't blame people for their implicit bias. Blame us if we don't do something systemically to overcome it.
Yeah. Well, and if everything becomes a workaround that works differently, then you don't have to think about it.
Right.
It just happens,
right.
whether it's technology or something else. So how do we ask questions? How do we get information in advance? Can we do exchange of information better in advance of the visit to get what the question is?
Fill in the EHR in advance.
Yeah. Or can we have other kinds of tools that will help do that? And then the other thing that Dave Lennox at Special Olympics Washington was saying is for all the healthy athletes program, this occurs in every state, and I know you have viewers from every state,
and Puerto Rico.
And Puerto Rico, which isn't
a state.
Should be a state.
It should be.
And Special Olympics also does this globally as well, but is this idea that they have to go somewhere. So if they do a screening and they go, okay, you've got high blood pressure, you need a referral for high blood pressure. They do two things. First of all, they create a report that summarizes what the problem is. Mm. So the athlete or the athlete's family can go with the athlete and bring it in and not have to do necessarily, they may do their own workup anyway, but like, we're here for the high blood pressure. You know, there's a problem with this, and you don't have to have the communication intro that can be hard about, doc, I'm here for X, right? And then you can go from there with what you need to do, right?
Got it.
And it's up to the doctor. And then secondly, they have a list of local people to refer to. So you need a physical therapist to help you with your knee pain, and you live in Redwood City.
Right.
Here's our list of providers who have told Special Olympics that they are open to taking people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And we don't know for sure if they've had training, but they have come to us and said, we are here for referrals from this population. Mm. And so I think one of the other take homes to your audience is, I think to the degree providers can get themselves or their institutions to be added to those referral lists just by calling their Special Olympics office in their region, that will increase, they will increasingly have more training videos and things for people who do that work, but it will also increase opportunities for that patient population to get access to care.
And these are not just children, these are adults.
I would say it's mostly adults. There are kids who do Special Olympics, but I think in this population, they were largely adults. And I walked away, I mean, I was so excited to go see this. I was fascinated. I loved the tour. I learned so much. I met a lot of athletes and talked to them about this. And I walked away from this really in tears, because I knew we were scratching the surface, that these were the healthy people who got in this population. The need is so much worse than these numbers reflect. And so I'm, you know, and you know, we were also talking, my colleague and I, about what can't we fix? We probably can't make the visit longer. You know, we can't make the insurance system more incentivized to do it differently. Those are big problems that are not going to get fixed. But what are the low-hanging fruit? What are the innovative things? How can we encourage all of the clinicians who and healthcare professionals who do interact with this population to do it differently. And I just, that's where I'm really interested in thinking about change.
So you had a couple of calls to action. One is reach out to your local Special Olympics mm-hmm. office and see if you can get on their referral yep. list so that you can provide access to yep. these kids. The second thing would be maybe to rethink or reevaluate or retrain in how you approach even the intake mm-hmm. of patients with disabilities.
Yeah.
How do you make it, and it's different for each patient. There's no one size fits all.
Right.
So maybe part of the system would be to figure out how to individualize mm-hmm. the experience.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things I think I've heard you say before in talks is you assume competence.
Yes. No, I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Assume or presume. Sometimes people say it both ways. Mm. And I think that's so important. And that's something I've learned as both a parent and a healthcare person involved in the healthcare enterprise is we all, again, going back to this implicit bias, I think we all see somebody with a visible or an invisible, and we just discover it, disability, and we make assumptions. Mm. And I see this in healthcare all the time. Oh, this is a person with, there was just a story about this happening with someone with autism where they're, not here, but somewhere else, where something got put in the EHR about this person has autism and therefore has mental retardation and doesn't have accurate information about their symptoms and what their needs are, which is, of course, not necessarily true. So there's all sorts of assumptions. And then it gets in the medical record. And then it gets copied and pasted over and over again and then, you know, and populated. And then that's that. So
don't make me rant about those EHRs.
EHR. So there's a whole, I think actually there are things we can do in EHRs to flag. This is this person's preferred communication method. This is what their diagnosis actually is. So you should go look at this, smart text about what questions you should. We could do things like that. That would probably help. But I think presuming competence is talk to the person, ask them or the person who's with them, how do you like to communicate? Mm. Say, hey, I want you to tell me both what's on your mind, not just what I'm asking you, because you might not think to ask the right question. And a person who has communication problems or anxiety problems or may not bring up, oh yeah, and by the way, I have this other health problem, they may leave without ever telling you because you didn't ask them, you know? And you didn't think they were there for that reason. So I think presuming competence is really a fundamental social justice issue that's in healthcare as well as in our society. And it's part of what Special Olympics is calling, but it's not just Special Olympics, this idea of an inclusion revolution. This idea that, and I'm not going to be the first person to say that we don't just need this in disabilities, we need this in other areas too, but in disabilities that still for far too long there's been segregation in our society in treating people with disabilities, whether it's physical or non-physical, differently and making them separate and not having them have full access to a lot of the benefits and resources that many of us take for granted. And how can we change our systems and change our approaches to actually promote inclusion in schools, in healthcare, in the political process, in just our local parks? My son's involved in this wonderful park here in Palo Alto, which is expanding the area called Magical Bridge, which is building inclusive parks for people with all kinds of disabilities. And so how can we think about small ways as well as big ways that we can do that in our daily lives?
And I want to reiterate something for the audience. If you guys think this is not a problem, that we are inclusive, that we have the ramps and we have the requirement for certain widths for the wheelchairs, and if you think that's enough, the Special Olympics data says otherwise, that adults and children who are probably at the end of the bell curve where they're getting the most attention, just in that they are athletes and they're competing, are having huge problems, dental, vision, health, podiatry, that are unaddressed, which means we as a system have failed to include them.
Yep.
And it's no different than segregating racial populations and treating one as if it's inferior or putting up barriers to access. And that can be unintentional. It can be an implicit bias, which we have to recognize and devise systems to overcome.
Unintentional. And I think the other piece of it is, I think that you're talking about morals and ethics. I mean, I think there's a moral argument for serving the healthcare needs of people with disabilities and thinking about how we can do that. But I also think there's an economic argument too. If
Tell
you want to make
that,
an economic argument, I mean, I think, and this is not just true for the population of people with disabilities, but the costs of not serving these needs and not doing preventive health measures and not treating things before they get really bad. I mean, we see people in the ICU who have severe dental infections plus a bunch of other things. And so there are significant significant healthcare costs to our whole system. There are significant impacts on our system. I think providers without guidance and coaching don't know how to best serve these patients. So that also affects the day-to-day working life of providers who are just struggling to manage their caseload and what they have to do that day. And so I think there are impacts beyond just why it's important morally and ethically to help people with disabilities. I think it affects all of us in other ways too. And also the other argument is some people would argue that all of us will be disabled in some way at some point in our lives or a family member. And so it's actually us as well.
Yeah, it's right? true. No. And you know, you brought up a thing. In the ICU, the biggest fear we would always have as docs is finding a dental abscess in a Medicaid patient.
Yep.
Because now it's an ordeal to find a dentist and no one's going to come to the hospital. Mm-hmm. They'll only do extractions, if that. And here's a potential source of infection, of sepsis, of inflammation, of stress, all these other things. Yes to everything you're saying. I think it's really cool that as a bioethicist, you've taken this on as a sort of a subspecialty.
I'm starting to, yeah. I mean, it's an area I'm trying to get more involved in. So I love that you invited me to do this because it's something I'm really passionate about and I'm wanting to do more and I'm interested to hear what people say too.
You're going
to
get a lot of comments. Yeah.
But the other thing I'll say is that I think the other piece of it is about values and quality of life. So the other ableist thing you were talking about, presumed competence, is I think if you don't know, and I've learned this as a parent, as a healthcare professional, if you don't know people with disabilities and you just know, oh, my sister's friend or the neighbor down the street or the guy at the grocery store that I see or whatever, you know, if you don't really know someone with a disability, you tend to have a bunch of assumptions about what brings quality of life and value to the life of a person with a disability. And one of the interesting things about Special Olympics, I think most people have heard of Special Olympics, but they don't actually really know much about it.
Right.
I certainly was one of those people until not that long ago, is that people with all degree of developmental disability, intellectual disability in particular, but physical disability as well, their perception of value of life isn't necessarily the same as someone who doesn't have that. And it's not true that they don't have any perception of value, that they don't have things that are important to them, that they don't have things that they do that they value important to them. And being able, for example, to go to their Special Olympics softball practice and games may be one of the things that gives them the most joy and may in turn help them with a work that they do or a day program they do or something else that they're doing in their lives that has value. And when they get so sick that they can't do that with healthcare issues that maybe aren't because of their primary underlying diagnosis that may be related to their disability, then they can't do those things. And so again, like to me, that's pretty fundamental. If you and I couldn't do the things we do in our daily lives, that would be a big deal to us, you know? And so
it's a question of beneficence. Are we doing something to help reduce, to bring them happiness or reduce suffering, non-maleficence? And you know, and that related to something I was gonna ask you about, this sort of morality around this quality of life for these patients, because we assume, again, like you said, the Down syndrome patient who's in a home, who may be, you know, a little older and has contractures and all that, that they don't, that they're not understanding what you're saying, they're not feeling something.
That's right. That's right.
Joy, hope, fear, sadness. And that is the deepest kind of ableist kind of bias.
Yeah.
And honestly, you know, look, when you're a resident training and you get that page from the ER, we have somebody from X home. You already know, okay, this is a home that takes care of people with intellectual disabilities, physical disabilities, whether it's Down syndrome, whether it's cerebral palsy, whether whatever it is. And you just go, oh, how am I going to talk to this person?
Yeah, maybe you've never done it before, right?
Right.
You're the resident, you may never have
mostly
had
not.
That. Yeah,
mostly not. And you don't know what to do. Yeah. And I remember being in that situation. And then, you know, I did a show that I'll send to you with a Stanford radiologist named Pete Poulos.
Oh, no, I've seen that show.
Oh, you've seen it?
Yes.
She's a fan.
Kind of a fan.
I love it.
It's where the closeness thing is sort of
I know, I know. I never get to interview fans.
Yeah,
it's,
no. I've
it's always
it.
People who
I've
hate
it. It's
me.
A great show about his experience.
About his experience.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
maybe
he went,
I won't say what it was. But.
Oh, now, he went from Stanford, UCSF GI fellow, had a biking accident in San Francisco, ends up with pretty much, you know, he's a partial quad, more or less, and is now finds himself in situations where he's misunderstood and misjudged. Now, he's practicing radiologist.
No,
I see him. He's a colleague of my wife.
Yeah, yeah.
We, you know, have dinner with him. But the thing about him is he went from this world of probably being fairly ableist, because he was a pretty, you know, my buddy was buddies with him before.
Yeah.
He's a different person before and after. Yeah. And now what is interesting is he'll roll around on his Segway, because that's how he's able to get around.
Yeah, it's really cool. Yeah.
And people will give him crap.
Yeah, people give him crap. No, I've heard he said that on your show.
Yeah. And you're just like, okay, just let's not presume the worst about people.
Yeah, well, and also ask people. Like, that's part of presuming competence, which, again, goes for every patient, whether they have disabilities or not, and your coworkers, too, is like, so what's important to you? You know, why is this important to you? How can I help you achieve that goal? And that your values also can change. All of us, our values, some of our values are constant, but some of our values change. His perspective changed. My perspective has changed as a parent and as someone who then sees this healthy athlete thing at Special Olympics. Our perspectives are evolving.
Yeah.
And so you can't, and again, with the purpose of being with disabilities, assuming they have no input and no sense of their own values is false.
It's false.
In almost every situation. I mean, somebody in your comments may point out there are people who really cannot interact in any way, shape, or form possible, and there's a whole separate show we could do about that.
Oh, yeah.
But the vast majority of people with any kind of disability do actually have opinions and values and things about their life that they value that they would like to communicate with you. It's important to figure out ways to ask that.
So my partial call to action is let's keep it in our minds when we're dealing with anybody, any human being, but in particular those who have the label of, you know, disability or whatever it is, and think about it. Now, so many of our fans have children with autism, and you see it in the comments, and these are, our fans are science-driven people, and so they want to make things better in a systemic level. They don't want to chase false stuff like vaccines and all that. They want to figure out, okay, there's one thing about what causes autism. There's another thing about how can we maximize their life experience and their contributions, and also how hard it is to parent.
Well, and as I don't think my son would mind my sharing that, as my own child with autism has gotten older, I have also thought about and tried to learn more about, you know, what it means to be someone becoming an adult with autism too, and what it means to become, you know, how do you? I guess I've become more aware of my own. I don't want to say bias in necessarily a bad way, but I am an able-bodied person, and while I've got plenty of, you know, of things in my medical record, by most people's definitions, I don't qualify as physically or intellectually disabled or developmentally disabled. So I get to talk about this as his mom, and I get to talk about this as a healthcare provider, but we need to talk to people who have these conditions and involve them, not only in their own care, but in how we think about what the healthcare system should do. And you know, the disability rights movement sometimes gets criticized, but I think one of the messages that they bring that I really have learned to endorse is nothing about us without us. And this idea that we don't know what, I don't know what it's like to be you, you don't know what it's like to be me. In healthcare, you have to make assumptions to take care of people, and you have to do the best you can. And, and so I'm not saying that you never make assumptions or you never group people or classify, but have curiosity about the perspective of people whose lives are different than yours and that you may not know what that is. So
I want to ask you, that's beautiful advice for anybody. And it comes highly, it's more poignant coming from you because you, again, are walking that walk.
Yeah, I'm trying to.
And here's a question. So the R word, retarded.
Yes, yes, yes.
That has recently really been pulled into the sort of realm of, you know, the F word regarding homosexuality or, you know, a bunch of things. What are your thoughts around this word and the stigma around this word and the use of by kids and adults?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because when I grew up and when you grew up, I think we're about the same age.
We can talk
about
that later. We may be a cohort. Scooby-Doo was a thing?
Yeah, Scooby-Doo was a thing. But I think...
Dukes of Hazzard. Dukes of Hazzard.
Yeah, Dukes of Hazzard. Absolutely, yes. Although that was more my husband than
me, Greatest American Hero.
Yes, Greatest. Oh God, we were singing that song the other day. Believe it or not, I'm walking on air. My children were mortified I was doing it in another place. So anyway, but I think the R word and the F word were cast around, you know, like they were nothing, but meant to be very stigmatizing and hurtful and all the things that kids do and say to each other. And then I think the adults in our cohort who grew up in that time still do that and still even make offhanded comments. Mm-hmm. They sometimes don't mean it badly. There's also concerns that we do this with mental illness, but that's all
a slightly different topic. The word crazy is used a lot.
Crazy, insane. Mm-hmm. But I think for the R word in particular, the R word is incredibly damaging. And I think one of the things that Special Olympics has taken a lead in this as well is trying to spread the word to end the word. And so they started trying to do programs in schools to try to sort of make people understand the power of that word and why it's hurtful. So not just you're a terrible person because you use that word, but like you've heard people use that word, so you don't understand why it's hurtful. Right. Let us explain to you. There have been a bunch of stories, even in the recent news, about entertainers using that word and why that's, and movies and other kinds of things and why that's problematic. I think the N-word is another word that has become appropriately completely unacceptable to use.
Right, right. Papa John's.
Papa John's. So that maybe decades ago wouldn't have had the same reaction to people using it. And so I think the challenge for healthcare providers is that mental retardation was a medical term, and I suspect was even part of the DSM at one point. Mm-hmm. And so there's sort of like, well, I don't mean it that way. I'm using it in a clinical way. what I mean?
Right.
And especially among older clinicians. And so I am very strongly supportive of efforts to spread the word, to end the word, and to get people to stop using it. But it is an uphill battle. I mean, even in my children's school, people still use it.
I tell you, my folks on my team use it.
Yeah.
And the thing is, you know, because in our writing space, we regress to whatever childish behavior we do.
And and you're on the boundary of also sort of what people are comfortable with. Like, we use things we learned when we were kids and even in training and stuff. And so I think it's hard to break those habits. I had a friend on Facebook once who I adore and who I think is wonderful, who was talking about her cat and said something like, yeah, my cat's riding the short bus.
Oh, yeah.
And I messaged her privately. Mm-hmm. I was like, so here's the thing. I know you didn't mean it that way.
Yeah, yeah.
But that means something different than you might think it means. And so maybe you didn't know that. And maybe that's not the choice of words that you might want to choose, knowing that you know that. So it wasn't, you're a bad person, I hate you, you should apologize, I'm going to publicly shame you.
Yeah.
It was, hey, that means something different than it did when we were kids. And you know.
So this is, I'm glad you brought up that phrase, short bus, because I was doing a Metamoji piece where I have my monkey primary care guy.
I know the monkey.
Yes, yes. And he was attacking, who was he attacking? Anthony Mercola, who's a kind of quacky, vaccines cause autism, all kinds of terrible things. So he was basically saying, well, this guy is so dumb. He is so dumb. He's smarter than any dolphin in the ocean. He's smarter, he's dumber than the smartest dolphin in the ocean. He was just going through this like spur of conscience.
Yeah.
And I said, even the dolphin that rode the short bus.
Oh, interesting.
He is smarter. Mm-hmm. He is less smart than that dolphin. Mm-hmm. And just an offhand thing.
I didn't see that one.
Yeah. Because you would have commented.
I would have probably got, or I would have.
And it would have been appropriate because what happened, we put it out and I got maybe five or six comments in the, a bunch of people, oh, that's hilarious. And then five or six comments, which were like, you know, the short bus thing. Mm-hmm. And some of them were like, you're a bad person for saying this. And some of them were what you said, which is, here's what that means to people who X, Y, and Z. And I was so uncomfortable after that. I was like, oh, and I couldn't.
Because you're a nice person, right?
Well, because then when it's explained and you go, you know, it never occurred to me. Mm-hmm. And now it makes perfect sense that it could be a hurtful word to a population of people. But the thing is, I can't edit it out. So Facebook doesn't let you remove it.
I know.
And the thing was already like so popular. And so what I had to do was, I just had to do a show where I explained myself.
Oh,
and
cool. That's great.
I didn't realize that this word had this context and this and this.
But
and this.
How many people learned something from you having that conversation?
Well, that was
Better than you just erasing the show or, editing.
That was the hope. And the thing is, again, like it's hard. I find apologizing for those things is a little awkward because it wasn't done with intent.
No, of course not.
Rather, I'll say, okay, now what I learned from this is this, that this is harmful, so I'm not going to do it anymore, and here's why. Right. So, you know, those things will happen, and we all try to learn.
And that's how we make it better is, like, by talking about it, right? I mean, I want to live in a society where we can have those conversations. And maybe people won't even always agree, but you hear someone else's perspective.
You want to hear something interesting?
Yeah.
I rode a short bus as a child because I was in a private school and they had a special short bus for us.
Well, that's the thing. A short bus isn't by nature created for special education.
Right.
It's not.
Right.
It's actually a function of the long system of the Individualized Education Act, or IDEA, in the United States about why people have to go to their homeschools and they have to move people with trans. I mean, there's actually a history in Yeah. But they can use a short bus for anybody.
Anything, right?
It's not, but people, it's associated with stigma.
Yes.
And it goes back to other public culture, popular culture representations of disability that are sort of, I don't mean knee-jerk in a bad way, but instinctual without reflection. Like, oh, I didn't realize that that person would react that way to my using that word or saying that thing.
Right.
I think the R word is moving more towards away. The short bus is maybe still more in the people
lexicon.
Haven't even thought about it.
Yeah.
The R word, I think, is starting, but I think it's highly variable. And again, kids, you know, they don't, how do we explain it to kids? Because that's where you learn it.
There's comedians that have done bits on the R word. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's a whole thing with Netflix right now.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
That's about that. So.
Right. Well, that's the subject of another.
That's another. Topic.
Another decision. So, boy, this is I've learned
that's
a
so much fun.
Lot.
And I'm with like you, who I've admired for a long time. So
Stanford professor.
I'm a bit of a fan.
Stanford professor.
No.
See, Dad, I told you.
No, the smart
people like us too.
Yeah. Hi.
Not just the Tom Heinemers, okay? Who are
He's awesome.
I can't say short bus, so I won't. But I'm just telling you, the bus he rode. Was of normal length.
Normal length. With closed-toed shoes.
With closed-toed shoes. Yes. Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, this has been fun.
Dr. Holly Tabor, what a pleasure.
Thanks.
Professor, Associate Professor of Medicine at Stanford, chair of the Biomedical Ethics Department.
No.
I said
you just promoted me. I'm Associate Director of the Stanford Center for Biomedical Ethics.
That's what I meant to say.
That's okay.
That's right. But, you know, I don't fire on all cylinders after. So, guys, here's the thing. If you want to share this with other people, share the video. Spread this idea about changing access for people with disabilities. Mm-hmm. And this will also be a podcast, which will be more easily chewed on if you're riding on a long commute than an hour-long video. So please feel free to share that, too. We're on iTunes at Incident Report and on SoundCloud and Stitcher and all the other nonsense. I know.
Are you not on anything?
Well, I'm not on Snapchat, because that's just dumb.
I was going to say, I think that's probably
that's just really not okay.
Yeah, no, I hear you.
That is a yes. So on that note, guys, thank you. And thank you, Dr.
Thanks so much.
Tabor.
It was awesome. So much fun.
And we out. Peace.